welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, recovery and resilience in a pandemic. So, Richard, things moving fast on the COVID-19 front. Lots of issues on both the legal and the economic side for us to get to. But let me start with something that a lot of our listeners have asked you to weigh in on. So over the weekend, prior to our recording this, President Trump publicly mused about the prospect of imposing a quarantine on New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And he backed away from that before we ever got any specifics on what it would actually entail, but presumably that would have involved, you know, obviously restrictions on people's ability to leave those states. We got a lot of questions for you about whether the president would have had the constitutional authority to do that had he gone through with it. What's your answer to that question?
Well, the answer is nobody knows because we've never had anything remotely like this. Let me give you the answer that was given forward by Walter Olson, who's, you know, a very serious man. And Walter says, no, this is something which is reserved exclusively for the state, and the president's only in charge of interstate commerce. And so the governors have the last say on this, and they can be as autocratic as their state constitutions permit them to be. And indeed, if you actually look at what they do, they're a little bit more autocratic than the state constitutions allow them to do. But if you do this pre-1937, that's true with the following caveat. The president would surely have the power to interdict, even under the current law, under that law, any movement across state lines. So he could say, okay, interstate commerce only means transit across state lines. I have a strong health justification. Nobody's going out of New York into New Jersey. Nobody's going through the Lincoln Tunnel, et cetera, et cetera. So that would be, I think, under the old view, a kind of a split verdict. And it turns out, of course, if you shut down the entire transportation system in the United States at the federal level, you have certainly influenced very radically everything that's going to be done at the state level. So that's the first point. The second point is that's the pre-1937 model. There's a post-1937 model, and that model says that the United States government at the center can organize labor relations inside various union stops. It says that the United States, through its exercise of its police powers, could tell state public officials whether or not they have to pay overtime wages to their sheriffs, right? And it can tell various people whether or not they could feed their own corn to their own cows. Well, if you've got that kind of power, then if you throw in the public health situation, the president's commerce power, which the left has always said has been plenary, which I've always fought, now turns around to be plenary on health issues. So you would then have the question, could he do it? Answer yes. How would you reconcile this with respect to the states? Well, we do have a doctrine, and it's called preemption. And the states are basically free to go unless the president wants to come in, with a couple of exceptions I'm not going to talk about here. But if it's a cheek-by-jowl conflict and the president says, I want you to essentially open up restaurants and to keep factories shut, or the reverse, and the governor say, no, 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 I think the answer is that the president wins. The problem, of course, is if he does this, it's going to be a huge Donnybrook, a huge legal fight. And I'm just going to remind you of something that I said many years ago before this show began, when I was on public television, about Bush v. Gore. And people said, well, don't you think it's perfectly sensible that we resolve this thing? And the basic argument is as follows. The moment you get something as high stakes as this, the smartest people on every conceivable side of the issue, and they're more divided now than they were in 2004, will dream up arguments so that the time you've gone through 24 hours of this stuff, your head will spin on both directions, and you'll have no idea to do. So what's going to then turn out is who gets a preliminary injunction against whom? I have no idea to that particular question. If my advice were to the president, I would say, please do not try to do all of this stuff. If you're going to try to do it through the purse rather than through the hammer. Tell states we're prepared to give you more aid if you liberalize what's going on in your particular jurisdiction in the following way. You're now in New York and allow people to complete construction projects, particularly in rural areas, and we'll pay you something to do it. But this is an absolute hornet's nest, and that's probably your first approximation as what would be a quote-unquote decent answer.
There is a striking passage in your most recent piece for Defining Ideas, made all the more striking by the fact that it's coming from you. You write there that, and this is a quote, there are no acceptable market solutions on how best to allocate scarce social resources for dealing with the coronavirus crisis. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, let me give you a case where there is a place where you could organize a market, then one where you can't, and then figure out which is closer to Corona. I've long been a fan of trying to organize voluntary markets for the exchange of kidneys, and the key feature is people who have kidney diseases have several months, even several years, in which to find a pairing with somebody who could give them a good organ. So there's no reason, in my judgment, for a top-down system, because what you can do is have the market. It will get the right people the kidneys at a lower price than the top-down system, which has this peculiar characteristic of giving the kidneys to those people who have the fewest qualities to use them. A quality, as I mentioned in that paper, means a quality-adjusted life year, and we use qualities in sort of all kind of medical ethical situations when you can't have markets because you have to figure out whom to allocate a research to, give it to the person whose qualities will be great. Then, on the other hand, you go to war, and it's in France, and you have triage. Now, let's suppose you have a bunch of people who are seriously wounded, some of whom are rich and some of whom are not. You got 100 people there, and you have to figure out what to do with it. Well, you want to start an auction in which, by the time the bidding is done, everybody is dead. Well, nobody wants to do that. There's no possible market exchange. So when you come into the army, they tell you we're using triage or modifying it. And essentially, the strategy is we're trying to figure out how to maximize with whatever resource base we have, and that's given from external stuff, the number of quality-adjusted lives that years that we can save. So you divide, you know, the world like Gaul into three parts. To those folks who are going to get better anyhow, give them an aspirin and tell them to rest. You don't want to spend resources on them. Then there are those people who are not going to make it no matter what you do, and you don't want to spend resources on them. And so what you do is you take that middle class and you spend all of your resources. And if you use this quality-adjusted life year situation, what you're doing is you're taking somebody whom, if you can fix this particular wound, will live 30 more years. That's huge. As opposed to somebody, even if you get them better, is going to have a lousy quality life for only a year. And so what you try to do is you trade off life against life. And the thing to understand about this, there's absolutely no market exchange system where some sicker person can say, I'm richer than you, I'll pay you to give this thing up. And so in the pandemic situation that we have here, it's also absolute chaos. And there are moral objections, there are social objections, there are legal objections. You cannot organize an auction. And so as in every emergency room, you kind of take people not first come, first serve, like you might if they're on a cafeteria line. You try to segment them in that particular fashion. And the hope is you could make a huge difference. And remember what the difference is. There is a customary, very tricky literature which announces that the value of a quality adjusted life year, or not of life, is say $10 million, and then you could figure out how much that means for years, say $50,000 or $60,000. You get the right person, and you spend, you know, $100 taking care of one person instead of $1,000 not fixing another, and you've got a return of, you know, $6 million in quality dollars. And so you really want to do this kind of thing, right? The first thing you want to do, however, in all of these cases, is try to expand the resource base so that you could put more people in the middle category than you could if it's very, very scarce. And for that, you need huge amounts of market liberalization so as to have things that are made very quickly, new drugs that are tested very quickly, because the more you get that on the market, the quality rate of return is astronomical. If you could get something on the market one day sooner than the next day and save another 20 lives, and you use this quality adjustment figure, you save $200 million worth of quality lives. That's a lot of non-dough. You don't have the money to do that. So what you do is you use the quality as a measure of effectiveness rather than as a demand for trying to say, we can save 5 million people if we spend all our money taking care of this virus. You spend $5 billion, that's 20%, no, rather 5% of the total wealth in the United States. You still got 330 other million people to deal with. You can't do it. So you use the quality this way, make the resource allocations the other way, and if you do it well, this will be far better than any alternative system, I think, than anyone has ever been able to devise. And there are places that I reported in that article in which triage is already being used. People hate it and use it because there's no better alternative. Somebody's going to die either way. You try to minimize the aggregate pain, and there's no compensation system that works, no market system that works. That's why I said that, because it turns out, alas and alack, the finest minds for the last 100 years have never been able to find a market solution, but they're able to find thousands of reasons why one cannot possibly emerge.
I want to ask you about some of the economic responses to what's happening that have been going on. So one of the provisions that has come out of the federal legislation on this is a $500 billion fund being administered by the Treasury Department to help businesses that have been affected by this. That's a mix of direct payments and loans. So, Richard, obviously the context for bailouts here, if we want to call them that, is different than with the financial crisis, this being precipitated by the shutdown around the virus. Free market types obviously don't like bailouts very much. Do they have to make a concession to them here as a necessary evil?
No, I think what you really want to do is, if you wanted to do this, what you'd take is all the large banks in the United States. And what you would do is you should supply them with a certain amount of cash based upon, say, what you think to be their net asset value. And then tell them, we want you to use this particular money to make the loans to those people whom you think are most notorious. And the difference is, you want the banks to try to help those things which are most likely to recover. So you'd use a form of financial triage. What would happen is those businesses that are already dead get no loans. Those businesses which will be able to survive it through get no loans, and you try to help it on the middle. The problem about having the government is that the allocation will not be based upon net aggregate return. And net aggregate return to a bank is a more accurate measure of social welfare derived from these things than any kind of political nostrum. So the answer is, you want to change the nature of the particular transaction, and you want to reduce the discretion of the public people, that is the government people, to deciding how much each bank gets. And then what you do is you monitor the performance of the banks and look at their portfolios and see what they have done. So I think there are much better ways to do it. Look, the point about this is, a crisis requires you in many cases to suspend market institutions, i.e. give a subsidy. But it doesn't require you to give a subsidy out in a really silly way.
So, Richard, the newest idea that we're seeing, this is not yet enacted, it's in the early phases. The newest idea that we're seeing for stimulus is a big push for infrastructure. So this, of course, was something that President Trump was pushing at the start of his administration. It's sort of fallen by the wayside in the interim. But the president and Speaker Pelosi talking about $2 trillion for infrastructure and arguing essentially, look, if you got interest rates at virtually zero, this is the time to do it. What do you make of that proposal?
Well, I mean, I certainly think it's the following problem is that you have zero interest rate rates, so do private parties. And so I think about infrastructure in a very different way. The current bottleneck under infrastructure is not construction. It's not technical. It's a statute called NEPA. We have project after project that get held up with the following kinds of trade-offs. Oh, you want to ship 500 barrels of oil through a pipeline in order to heat half of Southeast Florida, but we're worried about the bacteria that's going to grow on 380 feet along a pipeline that you haven't adequately considered. Let's slow this up for 2 years. So I think, in effect, what you really want to do is not have the government invest in infrastructure. We've got projects that are already on hold. And what you do, in effect, is you take any private project and you exempt it from NEPA. That is for preliminary approval. And then what you say is, guys, we don't want you making a mess of things. So if it turns out that you're going to do this, you have to get insurance, you have to agree to annual inspections, and you have to agree to tort liability coming out of the particular system. And if you do all of those three things, essentially what's going to happen is, it's what I said before. You're going to switch the dispensation from the center, where they have absolutely no idea of what to build, to think projects that are already there by people who, when they build them, are going to have to get private financing and have to show their general kind of utility. So you can separate, this is kind of like the voucher system, the need for a government subsidy, you could give that without having the government administer the program, just as you can give random money to public schools. Or what you could do is, you could give kids vouchers through their parents to do this. And one of the truly outrageous stories that I saw in the, I think, Wall Street Journal, is that the unions in the state of Washington, whether Oregon, have managed to persuade the governor that you shut down the school systems and you don't let voluntary charter schools open up. I regard that as just about criminal under these circumstances. So a good crisis should never be put to waste, right? We all agree with that, don't we? And the way in which you don't put these crises to waste is, you take every opportunity for market liberalization of a series of antiquated situations. Telemarketing, one of the easiest things in the world to legalize, you should do it. FDA permitting, it has been crazy ever since the Kefauver-Harris Act, which says you want the government to detect efficacy because they screwed up on a safety issue having to do with thalidomide. You get that out of the system, you could really run this stuff through. And remember what I said, this is is a way to avoid a genuine whole-scale recession. So if you look at what's going on now, the health people have clearly dominated the finance people in Trump's administration. And they're saying, well, you have to do this because we're going to have 2,700,000 dead. All right. Well, the finance people are just left to figure out how to manipulate interest rate. We need to get people back to work. And there's no system of transfer payments that will work. There was a nice piece in the Wall Street Journal. And what it said quite simply is, you want Keynesian stimulus? You can't give money out to firms who aren't allowed to open their doors. You have to find a way to get people back to work. You got to be able to do it incrementally. You have to have a better balance between the health types, who may be very severe on one end, and the economic types. My view about it now is, I think more of the stock market decline is probably attributable to the complete contraction of economic activity than it is for the hypothetical fears associated with the long-term impact of the coronavirus.
The last question that I'll put to you, because I was struck by two pieces that I saw yesterday within about 5 minutes of each other, and I apologize, I can't remember where they were, but one of them was making the argument that in this crisis, federalism is our strength and you need to decentralize and different jurisdictions have different needs here. And the other one said, America, essentially, get your act together. This has to be managed from the top down. Which of those is a closer approximation in your judgment of the way this has to be run?
Well, I think they're both wrong. Look, the traditional view on federalism pre-1937 gives the federal government control over the instrumentalities of interstate commerce, and that kind of makes sense. You don't want people getting on a train in one state and bringing this stuff to another state. It also, by the way, under the earlier view, said once you get there, the states can apply its local inspection laws to the people who get off the train, which seems to me about the right accommodation. The problem about having the local governments do it is, ironically, it's not granulated enough. You have New York. Essentially, there's a tri-state area, a little bit of Connecticut, a lot of New York, and a fair chunk of New Jersey, which is probably the source of over 50% of the deaths in new cases right now. A state's not going to do particularly well on that because you got a tri-state effort. Federal government's not going to do particularly well on that. You got to get a compact amongst those people. But why Mayor Cuomo said, or Governor Cuomo says, we're going to take care of the New York metropolitan area and I'm going to shut down Buffalo. This is a case in which there is no perception of what's going on. My own view about it is New York is kind of sui generis in the following sense. It was a place where you had the first very large jolt of this stuff come in, like it was in the Washington nursing facilities. And it turns out you have very high concentrations of people. You're going to have trouble. And if the virus starts to replicate more rapidly, it will get more severe. But in Buffalo, why do you have to shut that down now? I don't see it. There's a very difficult problem here, and one has to appreciate the gravity of it. There are two models that you can do. Both of them say you start slow. One of them says it mushrooms. The other says it tops off. You can't tell from the early data which it is, so you have to have some extrinsic situation. And the rough model that I would say is small towns you keep out of the system, bigger towns you're willing to do it, places that are hotter, more willing to let things ride than colder. We're not sure, but, you know, we got to make guesses, and you do it that way. So it's not so much federalism. Federalism allows somebody to take a state of New York and treat it in a completely asinine way. It turns out whoever is running this kind of stuff has to be prepared to trade off the public risk stuff against the economic dislocation stuff. And I see no sign on the part of anybody of a really conscious willingness to do it. This is the problem of siloed discipline. You get public health people who know public health, you've got economic people who know economics. What the president has to do is to find people who know both, and the same is true of all the governors.
All right. Thank you, Richard, and thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at definingideas at hoover.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.